Hello, my name is Andrew Pollard. Welcome to our podcast series, The Oxford Colloquy, bringing the facts, stories and people behind the science. On this podcast, we're going to be talking with the University of Oxford's pandemic vice chancellor about her experiences of leading the university during the pandemic. And we'll hear about her career, starting as a child in Ireland and through her academic training, both in Ireland and in the US, to become a leading political scientist before moving into academic leadership as a vice chancellor, first at St Andrews University and then at Oxford University. Dame Louise Richardson, president of the Carnegie Corporation in New York and former vice chancellor at the University of Oxford. Louise, welcome to this podcast.
Thank you very much, Andy.
So Louise was vice chancellor at Oxford for 7 years from 2016 until 2022, and previously was vice chancellor at St Andrews University from 2009. And we're going to come back to talk about her role at Oxford before and during the pandemic. But I thought it would be nice to start with the girl growing up in Ireland and who then went on to Trinity College Dublin to study history. What took you to Trinity to do history? Where did that fit into your vision growing up in Ireland?
Well, I grew up as one of seven children in rural Ireland, and nobody had gone to university, much less Trinity. But I read a lot. I was fairly ambitious, and Trinity was known as the best university in Ireland, so I resolved to go there. So I did. And from there, I won a scholarship to America, and I fell in love with America, with the meritocratic nature and can-do attitude of America. My initially scholarship was to the University of California. So I got a master's degree at UCLA. Then I got a scholarship to Harvard, where I got a PhD, after which I joined the faculty there. I remained there until I moved to St Andrews in 2009.
So in that long bit of your career, perhaps the first career that you had was in political science, and particularly with an interest and expertise in international terrorism and foreign policy related to that. I was interested to know where that came from. And you know, I'm sure a history degree gave you some insights into the way foreign policy shapes our history. But what took you towards the topic of terrorism?
Well, growing up in Ireland, I grew up as Northern Ireland was exploding, and I was keenly interested in terrorism. I grew up with a view of Irish history that was seriously challenged when I went to university and learned a very different version of Irish history. I became fascinated by how two sets of people in this small island could have diametrically opposed interpretations of the same historical events. And I knew people who were, I grew up in an environment very sympathetic to Irish republicanism, indeed Irish terrorism, if you like. So I went to America partly to escape what I felt was kind of narrow Irish nationalism, to study international relations, which I felt was as far away as I could possibly get from Irish nationalism. But of course, it really wasn't. It was just another lens on it. And when I came to America and started looking at the literature on terrorism, I felt it was highly oversimplified. Terrorists were seen as unidimensional bad guys and psychopaths. And I felt actually it was much more complicated than that, much more nuanced than that. So I spent my professional career really trying to understand how terrorist organizations function, how they recruit, how people who can be upstanding members of their society, teachers, students, parents, can join organizations and commit atrocities that violate every ethical norm. But I was also interested in decision making and how they make decisions under conditions of uncertainty. And I also worked on foreign policy decision making. So the unifying theme throughout my career, if you like, is trying to understand how organizations function and how to make them function effectively. And that came into play subsequently as I was leading universities.
And in that process, did you have to interact directly with terrorists? Certainly those of us who've dipped into your book on what terrorists want. I mean, it's certainly, I think, gives a lot of insight into, as you say, the complexities of the situation people find themselves in.
Absolutely. Well, before 9/11, it was quite easy or relatively easy to interview terrorists. And most terrorists are perfectly happy to talk about what they're doing. They believe their actions to be justified and are more than happy to talk about why they're doing what they're doing and to win support for what they're doing. So, yes, prior to 9/11, I used indeed to interview terrorists. After that, it became much more complicated in the US. But even then, we did manage to interview terrorists in other countries.
So there's one other thing I'd just like to ask you about, and it certainly sounds sort of a parallel activity that you have had is in forms of activism. And I read about your work, I think, as a student around the anti-apartheid movement, and then your travel to South Africa where you were subsequently arrested. So tell me what happened.
Well, I was very active in the Irish anti-apartheid movement as a student. I compiled a list of all the South African products sold in Ireland and organised a boycott. I would say part of the reason the Irish anti-apartheid movement was as strong as it was, it's not obvious that Ireland would have such a strong movement, was there was actually quite a few South African exiles in Ireland led by a man called Kadar Asmal, who went on to be part of the first cabinet in Mandela's first cabinet. The Dunn Stores is a big supermarket chain in Ireland. Some checkout girls had my little brochure, refused to sell Outspan oranges. They were fired. So some friends and I organized to bring them to South Africa. And that's how I came to go to South Africa. They were it's a long, complicated, exciting story. They were deported right on the spot, so they never got to stay in South Africa. We managed to talk our way through to initially persuade the authorities we were not attached to them. And we had an extraordinary visit with members of the ANC underground and so on within South Africa. And it was just an extraordinary time seeing the injustice of this society and seeing the spirit and the resilience of the people who lived under such appalling conditions was so inspirational to me. And I was completely appalled by the injustice of it. So I was quite exercised by that as a young person.
And your visit was organised by Bishop Desmond Tutu. Did you meet with him?
Yes, indeed. It wasn't organised by him. He invited us. So we pretty well organised it ourselves through the South African Council of Churches. Yes, we did meet him there. And one of the most seminal moments, actually, is we were having lunch with him in the home of a vicar after a church service in Soweto. This was actually the morning the emergency was declared. And at one point, one of the women who was in the kitchen came in and said, look outside. We opened the curtains and this little house had been surrounded by armoured Caspers. And moments later, some soldiers, 20-year-olds armed to the teeth, came in and said, get out. And I was in my early 20s. I was appalled. This was Bishop Tutu, and we had this young 20-year-old telling him to get out of somebody's house. I was furious. And Tutu, in one of the most extraordinary demonstrations of leadership, if you like, got out of his seat, and he started singing and jiving and going around the table saying goodbye to everyone. And you could see the soldiers getting more and more nervous, and they just wanted him out. And he was taking his own sweet time, and he was calming everybody down. At this point, a huge crowd had amassed outside, so it was quite tense. And he again just danced and jived into the kitchen and hugged everybody and gradually made his way out and left. And then, of course, we were left with the soldiers in this place. We went to our car, and the battery had been stolen. And in any event, it was a very interesting time.
And I guess one of those experiences in life which perhaps frames some of the interactions you must have had later on in thinking about international policy and how to behave in those situations, which I think Desmond Tutu certainly was a great example for everyone.
I thought just an example of courage and wisdom and an ability to diffuse a situation. It was really impressive, really admirable, I thought.
Wonderful. Fantastic story. So, of course, following your career in political science and the research that you were doing in the US, you started leading institutes in the US before coming to St. Andrews. And I think the first female vice chancellor at St. Andrews, and then here at Oxford, a university more than 900 years old, the first female vice chancellor here, which in some ways is a very special moment for the university. But I wonder how that felt for you. Does that feel like something special, or to some extent feel slightly disappointing that you had to be the first?
I think it would be disingenuous to deny the symbolic significance of the appointment. I had the advantage of being the first woman in St. Andrews, so I was sensitized to many of the pitfalls in these roles. And so, yes, I was aware that it was significant. Yes, of course, it's profoundly disappointing that it should take until now for there to be a first woman anything. And I like to say I look forward to the day when there will never be a first woman anything. And it's coming sooner, but the trajectory is slower than I'd like.
And have you found that the US, which, as you said, you fell in love with, has a different relationship with equality in that sense? Or is it exactly the same issues as we've experienced here?
Well, to be honest, it's been very slow in the US too. Not that many heads of universities have been women, and usually women are appointed and then they revert to the norm. So it's very, very rare for a woman to be succeeded by a woman. And it's always been one of my personal goals, I think, just about every job I've had I've been the first woman, but it's also been one of my goals to be succeeded by a woman. And because too often, and this has happened, we see it in the States, you appoint a woman, you've demonstrated your liberal credentials, then you can go back to the way things ought to be. And so if a woman is not a success in a role, there isn't a remote possibility that they would be succeeded by a woman. If a man is not a success, his gender is immaterial. So I've always felt it very important, and I've always been deeply gratified when I've been succeeded by wonderful women.
Well, it's worth saying at this point that our current Vice-Chancellor, Irene Tracy, is very much female.
A wonderful woman, yes.
Great success there. Had a wonderful Vice-Chancellor. So, of course, then back in 2016, you arrive at Oxford, 26,000 students and about 15,000 staff. It must have been fairly daunting to be taking the helm for anyone of the first university in the English-speaking world with so much expectation. What was it that you felt was you needed to do when you arrived at Oxford? What was the mission you had in mind?
Well, I saw myself as being a modernising influence on Oxford, and I was very committed to changing the socioeconomic makeup of the undergraduate student body in particular, but also changing the way Oxford is viewed in Britain. I mean, Oxford is respected, revered, admired, and emulated around the world, and yet coming in as head of Oxford, you were just buffeted day in by out, day out by criticism in the press, mainly over perceived elitism, but over one issue or another. I felt much of this criticism was unfair, but it was also damaging to us. I would go to see a government minister to talk about science funding, and all they'd want to talk about is admission of undergraduates. And of course, as I would say, I don't influence the admission of a single undergraduate. But so there was that. But there was also, unlike my predecessors, I didn't know Oxford at all. I'd never worked there. I'd never studied there. I'd only visited once or twice. So just trying to get a handle on how the institution worked. My first couple of weeks, of course, was also suffused with the issue of the Rhodes statue. So I was dealing with that from day one. The biggest surprise to me was the extent to which Oxford was in the news every day. I mean, every single day of my tenure, the first thing I did was open my phone and look at the press cuttings to see what crises had to be managed or what terrible things we were alleged to have done in the media. So
hopefully balanced with some positive news as well of the scientific discoveries.
Yes, but not that remarkably little. I mean, one of the great developments during my tenure, completely unrelated to me, was the change in how we were covered in the press. And we will get to the vaccine, but that's one of the reasons for this change. I think the recognition of just the contribution research universities, and particularly Oxford, can make. So I think it took me a while to get my sea legs at Oxford, to figure out how the institution worked, how to structure incentives so you could get people to do what you wanted them to do, because it's all about persuasion. Richard Neustadt wrote a book on presidential power, and he described it, he was talking about American presidents, but he described it as the power to persuade. And that's what I certainly felt my role as Vice Chancellor was, the power to persuade. Because Oxford like most universities, but as a more extreme case than most universities, it's not a top-down place.
Do you find that in these senior roles in universities that you draw on your academic expertise, rather than your personal experiences, but your academic understanding? Can you step back from the very complex situations you find yourself in, both internally in a university as also with external relations? Is there an academic in you that's thinking about how best to manage?
Oh, absolutely, entirely. And I do think that academics, ideally, academics lead universities because we understand we understand other academics, understand their objection to leadership, to managerialism, to the effort to turn universities into a marketplace, because we really value the life of the mind and see our, measure our success not by salaries, measure our students' success not by the status or size of their first position. And I share those values, and I see my role very much as protecting them and being an advocate for them. So I do think it's important to have academics at the helm. But I also, yes, I studied organizations. I think about organizations, and getting things done in Oxford requires you to stand back and figure out how you're going to get things done by understanding the incentives to which people will respond. So it's much more complicated.
As you say, a particularly complicated institution which doesn't really have central control. A lot of the power is devolved in Oxford to the periphery, which is pretty unlike most universities, and obviously most businesses are very much more centrally controlled in their structure. So I'm sure that provided some particular challenges for you. But has, when you look back on your time at Oxford in the pre-pandemic period, do you feel that some of the things that you set out to achieve have been very successful, and what are those? And where have things just not worked that you thought you might be able to influence?
Well, the things I'm proudest of is, well, I think we have made real inroads in changing the socioeconomic and racial makeup of the undergraduate student body. The evidence for that is we publish it every year. It's, I made a commitment that by 2023, 25% of our incoming British undergraduates would be from the most deprived backgrounds. We were at 23% last year. So there's that. The other thing I set out to do at the very beginning was to diversify our sources of revenue, because I felt we're in competition globally for academics, for talent. We simply don't have the money that our competitors have, and we don't have the resources that our Asian governments pump into their top universities. And I think we've been very successful at that. We did it in a number of ways. The first was through philanthropy, and we brought in, I think, 1.5 billion in my tenure, which was a significant amount of money, including a number of signature gifts like £180 million pounds from Stephen Schwarzman for the humanities, £100 million from Jim Ratcliffe for antimicrobial resistance, £88 million from the Rubin family for Rubin College, and so on. So and lots of smaller gifts as well. So that was one way of doing it. The other way, though, was to be bolder, if you like, about taking Oxford to the markets. So we took out a £1 billion bond. Century bond. So we'll have to pay this back in 100 years at an interest rate of 2.4%. So that, I'm absolutely thrilled by that. I think it was the largest, longest, cheapest bond in British history, certainly British higher education history. But it gave us access to resources to invest in the extraordinary academics and that we have, and provide them with the facilities they need. We also did a deal with Legal & General to put up £4 billion of capital, because, again, we didn't have the capital, to invest in housing for staff, housing for students, and so on. So I think we've achieved a number of things, and we'll come to the vaccine. That, of course, is one of the great successes of my tenure, even though I have no personal credit for it. Things that didn't go so well, I mean, I think we didn't address the cost of living crisis in the way that I'd like to. I mean, the fact is our academics are not paid on a level commensurate with our global peers, and I wish they were, and that's not something I managed to crack. And I worry about early career researchers in particular, and just how difficult their life is. I have a daughter who's a postdoc, and to see these spectacularly smart young people living on these precarious contracts, contract after contract, I wish I'd been able to do more about that. So we achieved a lot, but there's a lot left to be done.
Yes, and I think some of those are very difficult systems problems to fix, and perhaps need governments to deal with them. And I guess one question that arises from that. Obviously, you've gone from a political scientist actually into quite political roles in the sense of leading organisations. And you weren't tempted to take the step actually into politics?
No, absolutely not. I'm fascinated by politics. I'm a politics junkie, but I always felt I would never enter politics because I'm much too private a person. And one of the unpleasant aspects of being Vice Chancellor of Oxford was a much more public role than I anticipated or that I like. So that's actually the main reason. The other practical reason is, of course, I've lived my life in various countries. I've lived in Ireland, I've lived in America, I've lived in Britain. In whose politics would I participate? You know, where I think I used to, when I was trying to decide where I would spend my life, I used to feel Ireland was too small, America was too big, maybe Britain was the optimal size. But I wouldn't imagine being involved in British politics. No, it's too ugly.
And complicated. So let's move to the pandemic. And so you were sitting as Vice Chancellor when that pandemic arrived. And my first question is, when were you aware just what an impact that the pandemic was going to have on your staff and students? And how did you think about pulling together an understanding of how to respond?
It's probably late January when John Bell, the Regius Professor of Medicine, John Bell, called me. I was, of course, following it. And I think that's when I first realized just how serious it was. I remember conversations with Gavin Screeton a couple of days later, the head of our medical sciences division. So by late January, we realized this was going to be bad. And by so in February, we started to put the mechanisms in place. And again, this is a uniquely Oxford way. We mobilised what we call the crisis management framework. But knowing Oxford as well as I did at this stage, and I was very glad I'd been there a few years, I knew a conventional crisis management framework would only alienate people. So we decided to call the senior decision-making body the Silver Group. So some deliberate constructive ambiguity there about where authority really lay, because within the university there's technically, it's congregation, which is all, 7,000 people and a deeply dysfunctional entity. I thought there's no way they can make decisions in a crisis. Our council is large and a cumbersome body, so I felt we needed a small, representative, but flexible, informal, fast-moving group. And we convened this group. We called it the Silver Group. And so not arrogating authority for ourselves by doing the conventional thing and calling us the Gold Group, let people surmise where gold was. We were just interested in getting things done. And so convened a group with representatives from the colleges, representatives from each of the four academic divisions, as well as the pro vice chancellors.
So a lot of very complex decision making to put in place during all of that. To what extent was this all just happening internally? And to what extent was this something which the major universities around the UK were talking to each other and trying to do things in a synchronised way?
I don't think we were. We did talk to one another through the Russell Group and so on. But actually, no, it was pretty much we were doing it internally. I mean, most places are not as devolved as we were. Most places were much more top down. Every place else had a kind of gold command who made decisions. But I think the university came into its own because it really worked, because the colleges were small entities, small communities. They could look after the individual needs of their students. I'll give you one example of just how complex it was. In Michaelmas term, which is, say, the autumn term 2020, we decided we were bringing students back. But we were in active discussions with the city, who were very nervous about bringing back these 26,000 students and what this would do for infection rates in the city. So we decided we would require students to sign a responsibility charter. Now, Oxford is just has a visceral reaction to requiring anything. Most universities do, but with us it's more acute. So many of our debates in Silver was whether to encourage something, strongly encourage it or require it. Responsibility charter, we said we're requiring this. But in order to do this, we had to get all 39 governing bodies of the colleges and indeed the six private halls. We couldn't just talk to the heads of college because they couldn't decide for their colleges. This document had to be parsed and debated in each one of these governing bodies to get them to sign up to it. And invariably, of course, some of them will resist or want this or that or whatever. So it did require extraordinary patience, which is not my strongest suit, but also extraordinary perseverance in just getting something as relatively simple as that through. But once we got it, then it was implemented. And I do think our students had a better experience than students in most universities because of the extraordinary hard work of so many colleagues across the university. And there really was, in the early days, especially a Dunkirk spirit. And it was really moving how many retired GPs came back to help in our testing services. I mean, to me, one of the most emotional moments of it all was when I think it was April 2020 that our young medical students graduated early so that they could join the front lines. Yeah, that to me was one of the seminal emotional moments throughout all of this, to see these young people going to be medics in wards before they'd even finished their degree.
And that sort of devolution of responsibility made a greater sense of ownership across the institution than
Absolutely.
Might have happened if there was central control. And
although
more of a struggle, it may have been a good thing overall.
I know. I do believe it was a good thing overall. Absolutely. As I say, I do think the university came into its own precisely because of this.
So when did you first get involved in the discussions about the vaccine? I mean, obviously today when we look back, more than 3 billion doses of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine have been distributed, and we know that millions of lives have been saved. But at the beginning, there was a lot of uncertainty. So when were you first involved in discussions?
I think it was very early on. Again, I think probably the end of January, when Gavin Screeton, who is the head of medical sciences, came to see me, and he said that some of the people in the Jenner were working on a vaccine that they thought might really help, but they had absolutely no money and they could either spend their time applying for grants or get on with working on it. So, and I said, how much do they need? And he said, well, they need about £1 million. Is there any way we can find it for them? And he said, look, if this works, we'll get the money back because they will get funding. And he said, if it doesn't work, and I remember finishing the sentence, I said, if it doesn't work, we're going to have bigger problems than covering £1 million. So I said, yes, you know, we'll find £1 million. So, you know, let's get them going right away. So early on, I was aware that we had potential work underway. Again, I was in regular contact with John Bell, who was in contact with the government, in contact with colleagues overseas. He was constantly updating me on the progress of this vaccine, on what was happening, you know, what might happen overseas. So fairly early on. And then, of course, this being Oxford, there were one of the early seminal decisions was that this vaccine, if it worked out, would be available. We wanted it to be available at cost, because so many of our academics, as you know well, who've worked in this area, have worked in Africa, and it's always the developing world which is last to get the vaccine. And we felt also, as a publicly funded institution, we shouldn't be profiteering from a pandemic. So that was a pretty important decision early on.
And of course, the effect of not-for-profit is that if you do have a successful vaccine, then there is no perverse incentive to sell just to rich countries.
Exactly.
It's just as valuable to sell it to
exactly.
low-income settings, middle-income countries. And of course, then it can be directed at those in the whole world who are at greatest risk, which, as we knew even in February of 2020, were the elderly.
Absolutely. But when you're in a university, of course, everybody has an opinion. So I was receiving lots of emails from people, critical of any decision we make, either that we should be simply making the TRIPS waiver, I guess, making our information available to anyone so that they too could try and develop a vaccine. We were worried about that because liability, we didn't know if this was going to work, this could be dangerous and so on. We thought the best bet was finding a commercial partner. So I was very much involved in those discussions ultimately with AstraZeneca. And that was hugely interesting piece. So I was very much involved in negotiating the deal and the contract with AstraZeneca and in trying to manage this relationship with them.
Was it easy to persuade them to go with the not-for-profit concept?
Yes, I think it was. And I was not the one that persuaded them, but I think it was relatively easy. The difficulties were in just trying to mesh the culture of a university with a large international, multinational corporation. So I was very much involved in the details of the contract with them. But then managing the relationship was quite difficult. And there were many occasions in which we had to have sit-down meetings, or everything was by Zoom, with the CEO and head of research of AstraZeneca and John Bell and myself, when we felt that the terms of the contract weren't being adhered to as planned. So I would say I'm absolutely delighted we did this partnership with AstraZeneca. And one of my worries is that I don't think any company is ever going to do that again. It was extraordinarily enlightened of them. And I feel they've gotten no credit for it, and certainly not the credit they deserve for doing this. And the companies like Pfizer and Moderna, who are charging 10 times for their vaccine, notwithstanding the fact they got $1 billion of support from the US government, nobody has felt that was illegitimate in any way. So I don't think AstraZeneca have gotten the credit they deserve. And that's really unfortunate, because I think no company is likely to make the same kind of deal again. It was very important to us to get a company that was British. And I say this, we were worried that if we did a deal with an American company, and I think it's in public that we were talking to Merck, for example, that given the nature of the Trump administration in the US, that maybe if the manufacturing was done by an American company, maybe we would never get access to the vaccine. And certainly the countries we wanted to get access to would not get access to it either.
And I suppose that, as happened, the vaccine has become the most widely distributed vaccine for that reason, because there hasn't been any block on its distribution. And that hasn't been the case with some of the vaccines developed in the US.
Right. But the fact that the US has never accepted our vaccine is a source of profound annoyance to me.
Well, perhaps it needs a political scientist to look into that question.
More than that, I'm afraid.
So with the relationship with AstraZeneca, as you said, definitely a few headwinds and differences in culture. But I certainly, for myself, having worked very closely with them, looking back, I have quite a warm feeling now about it, despite some of the bumpy times along the way. And they did an extraordinary thing.
They did, absolutely.
In coming on board with us, with an academic institution, and with all of the uncertainties for a big pharmaceutical company.
Absolutely. I have only admiration for them. I would say the other difficulty, of course, which is one that universities will face, was before we could do the deal with AstraZeneca, some of the scientists working on the vaccine had formed a spin-out company, which is something universities encourage. And that company had some Silicon Valley investors. But in order for us to do the deal with AstraZeneca, we had to get back the IP that had gone to this spin-out. And that was perhaps the most difficult of all the negotiations. These Silicon Valley investors had none of the altruism of AstraZeneca or Oxford, and the negotiations with them were exceptionally unpleasant and difficult. We did eventually manage to get the IP back so that we could do this deal. But again, I think there's a lesson there in some of the unintended consequences of spin-outs. Who would have predicted that this might happen? But there you have it. The other thing that was so interesting and unexpected in all of this was just so many of the headwinds our vaccine ran into for political reasons and others. As you've mentioned, I work on terrorism, so I have lots of friends and former colleagues who spend time on the dark web looking at following what the bad guys are doing. And one of them got in touch with me, again, relatively early on, or certainly in the summer of 2020, with evidence of really nasty stuff on the dark web about our vaccine, calling it the monkey vaccine and so on. So deliberate spreading of misinformation, trying to damage our vaccine. I think trying to, this strategy of sowing dissent amongst the Western allies. So that was fascinating.
And in fact, that story was eventually picked up by the Times newspaper, who had obviously researched it and track that back to Russia and to the manufacturer of the Russian vaccine.
So again, one doesn't expect as a VC to be drawn into that. I would say that I certainly saw my role vis-a-vis the vaccine primarily as supporting and protecting the scientists who were doing their work. And we did get lots of terrific support from the security services and intelligence services to protect the work and so on.
And was that because of particular cyber threats or was it physical threats? What were the things that you were dealing with around protecting the staff?
Well, I think there were more cyber threats. There were a couple of physical threats, but none that we worried about very much. It was more cyber threats. So yeah, but as I say, I saw my role mainly as trying to provide just free space for you and your colleagues who were doing just this extraordinary work to be able to get on with it and not be distracted by all the political shenanigans or one thing or another, just to be able to do your work. So that's where I felt my role was, just trying to play interference, really.
Well, I think you did that extremely well. And so now, I mean, you mentioned the many headwinds that the vaccine faced, both during development and then subsequently. And I guess one of the difficulties is managing a global media that is interested in that. And as you said, it's perhaps not something any of us had really expected to have to deal with. Do you feel that we should have done something differently in order to manage the messaging that there was?
Well, to be honest, I think our own very small comms team were fantastic and worked extraordinarily hard and did a very good job.
Award-winning comms team, actually, in the university for the work that they did on the vaccine.
They were terrific. I hope it's not too impolitic to say. I think they're a lot better than the AstraZeneca, much larger comms team, whom, again, they were, as I say, I have only admiration for AstraZeneca. They were operating under extraordinarily difficult conditions. And yet, I don't think they managed the comms as well as they should have done. Part of the problem in the US was a comms problem. I mean, it's always easier in hindsight to know what we might have done. I do think perhaps AstraZeneca might have managed their comms more effectively than they did. But overall, for us, as a university, you know, this was demonstrating the power and the extent that research universities can contribute to society. So this was a wonderful demonstration of the importance of research universities. And so in that sense, it was a real triumph.
And I think especially when you look at the context of around 350 vaccines that have been in development since 2020, and the World Health Organization has only approved 8. And it just shows what an enormous impact a university like Oxford has had in being able to develop with so little resource.
So little resource and at such speed. It was really quite extraordinary. But also the other context, of course, was this was coming on a period in which the whole question of expertise had come under dispute, where famously a cabinet minister had said, we've had enough of experts. But suddenly we couldn't get enough experts. And I think yourself and your colleagues were constantly in demand on the news media, explaining what was happening, explaining vaccines, explaining the trajectory of the disease, and so on, to a degree that was enormously reassuring to British society, again, demonstrating the value of our great universities.
So you're now at the Carnegie Foundation. So what are you doing in New York? What does the role involve?
Well, Andrew Carnegie was an immigrant from Scotland, a self-made man who started off working in cotton factories as a child and became the richest man in the world. And he resolved to give away all his money before he died. So he built 2,600 libraries because he had taught himself by going to public libraries. He created things like Carnegie Hall, Carnegie Mellon University, and so on. But he realized he wasn't actually going to be able to give away all his money before he died. So he put his residual fortune into what he called a corporation, called the Carnegie Corporation of New York, and said he didn't want to restrict subsequent trustees. He trusted their good judgment to use this money to promote understanding amongst the people of the United States. We have interpreted that in recent years in three ways. We invest in education. We invest in strengthening democracy and in promoting peace. He did his utmost as the wealthiest man in the world, as an extraordinary optimist. He thought he could prevent World War I, and he couldn't. And he actually suffered essentially a breakdown when World War I took place. So we have tried to support peace promotion efforts. So they're the three: promotion of peace, education, and strengthening democracy. And it's such a natural fit for me because I spent my career in education. My work is, I think, around the areas of international peace. So the job is to identify people who are really making inroads in these areas and give them money to support their work. So it is an extraordinary privilege to be able to do this.
As you say, perfectly bringing together those various different aspects of your career. So if you think back to that girl growing up in Ireland, what else might you have done with your life if you hadn't gone down the route that you did?
Well, the two other careers I contemplated were being a diplomat, but I felt that the Irish Foreign Service was, and Ireland was so small, that would be restricted. And the other was to be an international human rights lawyer. And so I came close to pursuing that path on several occasions, had a place at law school at one point. So they were they're the two other likely career paths.
And what do you do in your spare time when you're not leading organisations?
I read a lot of fiction. It's my means of relaxation and escape. I serve on the board of the Booker Prize Foundation. So I read a great deal of fiction, and I love exercise. And I love getting together with my family, which, given that we're separated, you know, I spent the entire pandemic on my own, rattling around this great big vice chancellor's house with my husband and daughter in America, other kids elsewhere. So getting time with my family is rare and really precious, and there's nothing I enjoy more.
Dame Louise Richardson, thank you for steadying the ship here at Oxford with your very clear focus during the pandemic, and our very best wishes for your new role at the Carnegie Corporation.
Thank you so much, Andy, and thank you for everything you did during the pandemic.
Thanks, Louise. That was the Oxford Colloquy. Thanks for joining us in our podcast, bringing you the facts, stories, and people behind the science. So you might be wondering, what is a colloquy? We've called this podcast series the Oxford Colloquy. Well, a colloquy is a discourse or a conversation, and hopefully you'll agree that that's what we've been having.